This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. We're hearing from the White House this morning that President Barack Obama will delay his trip to Indonesia and elsewhere in the South Pacific. The president had planned to leave next Thursday, but the health care bill is at a critical juncture in Washington, so possibly not a great time to leave Washington, D.C. NPR White House correspondent Don Gagne joins us now. Hi, Don.
Hey, good morning.
So what specifically is the White House saying about this delay in this trip?
I can tell you we are hearing everything they have to say so far in 140 characters or less. They tweeted it this morning, and to my as far as I can tell, it's the first time we've gotten confirmation on a story like this that way. But here's what Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said in that message. The president will delay leaving for Indonesia and Australia. He will now leave Sunday. The first lady and the girls will not be on the trip. They had originally planned on accompanying the president. So that is officially what they have said. But again, they have been getting pressure and a lot of questions over the last several days, wondering why he is leaving on this trip with health care coming to such a critical place, how he could possibly even consider leaving. So we now get this today. Not a total surprise.
Well, where was Mr. Obama when he was going on this trip, specifically mm-hmm. where he's supposed to go? Why was he going on this trip in the first place?
Well, the first stop was going to be Guam, then Indonesia, two stops in Indonesia, Bali and Jakarta, and then on to Australia. In Australia, he was going to mark the 70th anniversary of relations between the United States and Australia. So very important, especially for the Australians, to have him there. In terms of the actual itinerary. In Guam, he was going to meet with U.S. service members there. Indonesia, of course, is the most populous Muslim country in the world. And the president still presumably plans to announce a comprehensive partnership of some kind between those two nations on that trip. And again, it's part of his outreach to the Muslim world. Also worth noting that he spent some time in his youth in Indonesia. So it's kind of a bit of a homecoming. And he will certainly be welcomed as a former resident when he goes there.
The delay, though, does free him up to continue to press for health care. What do you expect to see next week from the president?
Look for him to hold a lot of healthcare-related events. There is already one scheduled for Strongsville, Ohio, on Monday. That's not too far from Cleveland, and it will be very similar to the one he held in St. Charles, Missouri, earlier this week. And then there was also one in Philadelphia on Monday. So he's trying to get out around the country to really frame the issue in the way that he sees he needs to frame it, to put pressure on especially Democrats who are wavering or nervous or reluctant to vote for health care legislation. But here is the other thing. The White House had set this deadline of March 18th. Again, it was kind of an arbitrary deadline. It was set to have things done before he left on this trip to have everything wrapped up. And it looked like that wasn't going to happen. We now see that Congress has already delayed that. So this frees him up to twist arms. Also worth pointing out that in the past, when he has left the country at critical points, especially last November when he went to China, they seem to lose the momentum they had. They don't want that to happen this time.
NPR White House correspondent Don Gagne, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
In show business, there's a saying, the show must go on. And so this week, a select group of fashion editors gathered in a Parisian salon to view the pieces that designer Alexander McQueen was working on before he committed suicide. McQueen was known as a hooligan of high fashion because of the way he barreled through life, thumbing his nose at popular convention. He worked under great secrecy, and the fashion world was eager to get a glimpse of his last collection. Robin Givhan is the fashion writer for The Washington Post. She was one of the lucky few on hand for the Paris preview. In fact, she just got back from France, and she joins us now. Welcome home.
Thank you. It's very nice to be home.
Sounds like you haven't even had a chance to unpack yet.
Well, certainly not enough time to do my laundry.
Well, tell us about the clothes and about what perhaps inspired this collection.
Well, these were the 15 pieces that he had cut himself on a dress form without the use of a pattern and had completed himself. He was inspired by the paintings of old masters, you know, Botticelli and Hieronymus Bosch. One of the interesting things that he did was to take the actual images and have them digitally printed on the clothes and sort of shrunken down a little bit so that they actually fit the clothes. So you got these really extraordinary prints that looked like you were actually viewing a work of art.
The clothes are absolutely luscious. The colors and the brocade and the intricate beading. What does that say about his state of mind?
You know, it's so hard to know, and I feel like it's almost just, you know, presumptuous to even attempt to know. But what I thought was interesting is that these are not clothes that come across as angry or sorrowful or melancholy. They're just extraordinarily beautiful clothes.
Robin, we love speaking to you because you're able to call upon your great descriptive powers, and we're going to ask you to do just that in describing one or two of your favorite pieces.
Well, I think my favorite piece was probably the finale piece, which was a coat that sort of fell about mid-calf, and it was constructed entirely of feathers, golden feathers. I mean, they really looked like, you know, a winged creature that had just sort of folded its wings in on itself. And then from the bottom of this coat, you could see what appeared to be a full-length gown that was just sort of exploding from the hem. And it was just all white tulle with gold embroidery on it. And it spoke really to a lot of the things that he was known for, the precision of the construction, the emotion that each piece was filled with, as well as just this sort of wild, wild imagination.
May I ask you about one outfit in particular? There's a pantsuit in here that looks like that something Get Christie Love might have worn. It's gold, and it's got this tight cinched belt, and I want you to tell our listeners about it.
Well, one of the things that people should really know is that for all of McQueen's theatrics and drama, he was fundamentally a tailor. The man could cut a spectacular suit. So even in the midst of, you know, these other pieces that are such sort of high fashion art, he could still cut a suit that worked in that context.
Was there any consternation about a posthumous show?
I don't think so. I mean, I think for a lot of people, there was obviously the curiosity to see what he was working on. But I also think that people felt like, you know, a lot of these garments had been completed, and it would have been sort of sad for people not to get a chance to see, you know, a little bit of his creativity for one last time. I mean, certainly at the end of the show, there wasn't a designer to come out at the end and take a bow, and that was very much felt. But I think it was a very respectful way to honor the work without making people feel like they were somehow being inappropriate voyeurs. I think it was a really well-balanced presentation.
Robin Givhan is a fashion writer for The Washington Post. Robin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Some of the problems Lehman Brothers executives were trying to shuffle off the book were those troubling things known as toxic assets. Toxic assets threatened to bring down the global economy. Hundreds of billions of dollars worth of home mortgages packaged into complicated bonds, and no one wanted to touch them. Well, now these things are starting to move, and our Planet Money team has been wondering what's become of them. They thought the best way to find out was to actually buy a toxic asset. David Kestenbaum and Hannah Jaffe Walt report.
There's no store you can go to buy toxic assets.
You have to know a guy, and we know a guy.
So, my name's Whit.
Whit Solberg. He used to work on Wall Street. Now he set up his own shop, Mission Peak Capital, here in his hometown, Kansas City.
Whit and a dozen guys sit at desks with their tools. 2 to 4 computer monitors, 3 to 5 bags of potato chips, Snapple, chewing tobacco. And all Witt does all day is look at those monitors, spreadsheets, numbers, mortgage data, evaluating toxic assets, and sometimes buying one.
But the thing is, you don't always know what you're getting. Witt compares this to buying a cow at an auction.
The big black Angus cow that everybody wants, we're not buying that cow because it's too expensive. We want the cow that kind of got a wounded leg, but she might produce a few more calves for us and is cheap. So why don't we run the 051 MV8?
Witt starts searching for a bond we might want to buy. And what searching looks like is checking your email. Brokers keep sending him announcements about which toxic assets are for sale today. One says, cheaper, super senior steel.
Bobby sends a lot of email, Cliff and Dwayne. And
to figure out which bond might be a good buy for us, Witt has a computer model, basically a very fancy spreadsheet named Brandy, named after his wife, who built the thing. Brandy takes all the information on all the mortgages and tries to make sense of it.
If you bought a home in the last 10 years, it's possible your mortgage is in here.
And Brandy, the model, is asking these questions about you. Where is your house? Are you making your mortgage payments? Who made you the loan? She does this with thousands of mortgages. Meanwhile, Witt is scanning the screen, yelling, what's Brandy telling us here? Oh, Brandy likes it. Oh, wow, check out Brandy's loss severity there.
Around lunchtime, Witt finds a bond he likes for us.
It's a type of bond called an omelet bond. That's an acronym for Option 1 Mortgage Loan Trust. Witt thinks we should offer to buy the omelet for half a cent on the dollar.
In other words, less than 1% of its original value. Witt calls one of those brokers who sent him the emails, a guy named Cliff, tells him, half a cent on the omelet. And then we wait. Finally, Cliff calls back.
Hey, Cliff.
Hey.
What's happening?
So that omelet bond?
Yeah.
They're seeing high teens on that.
High teens, 17, 18 cents on the dollar. More than 30 times higher than what we bid.
That's bull. That's ridiculous.
Wait, so what happened with the omelet? Somebody bought it for high teens?
That's what they're telling the trader.
And you bid half a cent?
So there's real disagreement about what these things are worth.
There's huge disagreement. I mean, honestly, this is not uncommon.
After our omelet failure, we move on. Witt gets excited about another bond. He looks through his fancy spreadsheet. It has big loans, meaning big houses, McMansions in California.
But he only has minutes to make an offer on this one, and there isn't enough data to evaluate it. So Witt does something that makes me kind of nervous. He yells, print the book!
The book is the prospectus, a 604-page document no one ever expected anyone to read. It describes the bond in excruciating detail.
As the printer tray fills up, I realize I'm staring at an historical record of the entire financial crisis. It's all here on these pages. Vaporized companies, people struggling to pay their mortgages, and some horribly complicated logic describing which bondholders get paid in which order, how much, under which conditions.
Witt hunches over the pages with three highlighters and a pen, circling stuff, turning the pages quickly, time running out. And then he stops. There's a hidden time bomb on page 136.
You're laughing. That doesn't seem like a good sign.
In the event of insolvency of Lehman Brothers, payments due under the interest rate cap. Dude, this is a disaster.
This is a disaster.
The disaster is the deadly interest rate swap. You don't need to know what that is. It's bad. We're not buying it.
We go on like this for 2 days, and finally we find her, a beautiful, totally toxic asset at what Witt thinks is a good price, $36,000. The original sticker price was a lot more.
$2.7 million.
Meaning that's how much money, in theory, is supposed to be coming in from all the mortgages.
Yeah. Wow.
So someone was holding it expecting it to be worth a lot more money.
Yeah, somebody, a human being or an institution paid $2.72 million for this within very recent history.
And you bought it for $36,000.
That's right.
We buy a piece from Witt for $1,000. It's going to be our encyclopedia of the financial crisis.
So what the heck did we buy? Our toxic asset, she has 2,000 mortgages all over the place, a lot in the worst hit parts of the country, California, Arizona, Florida.
Here's a guy, pretty nice Sarasota place, right?
You can tell a zip code.
Yeah, there's a zip code, golf course community, maybe a cul-de-sac, something like that.
A lot of the people in our bond are really struggling. Almost half are behind on their mortgage payments. 15% of our homes are already in foreclosure.
And at some point, those homes will be taken over and sold for a loss. Every time that happens, the bond shrinks. At some point, our part of the bond disappears entirely.
But until then, we get a little money every month from people paying off their mortgages. We just got a check for $141. If we keep getting checks till Thanksgiving, we could double our money.
What's the worst thing that could happen?
Next month they sell all the houses and you get stuck with nothing.
So now we're toxic asset investors. What does that mean? Are we helping unclog some big bank's balance sheet? Are we helping the homeowners?
No. You're not helping these people. If you have any reason to purchase this product, the reason is to make money. But
are we helping the people who owned this stuff that we bought
no.
it from?
No, because what would have happened was that they'd have to recognize that loss. 99. They would have bought it for 100, and now they've just recognized the fact that they've lost 99.
I see. So what we're actually doing is we're saying to whoever holds this, you think you don't know what it's worth, or maybe you think it's worth whatever, and we think it's worth two cents on the dollar.
Yeah, you've raised your hand, and you said it's worth a penny and a half. And by the way, that's better than nobody raising their hand at all.
Of course, there could be a reason no one was raising their hands. It could be worth less than a penny on the dollar.
However this investment turns out, we'd like to meet some of our partners in the pages of this gigantic financial transaction. If you bought a home in 2005 in Sarasota zip code 34232.
Or if you've owned our toxic asset, CUSIP number 41161PUA9, let us know. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Chana Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
In case you're wondering, our reporters spent their own money. Any proceeds will go to charity. If they lose money, well, they lose. You can follow their progress at npr.org/toxic.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care advocate 24/7.
The aftershocks of the economic crisis hit one Midwest city hard. Elkhart, Indiana, is a manufacturing town that saw its unemployment rate rise to nearly 20% last year. But as we'll hear in the next few minutes, some entrepreneurs there are optimistic that Elkhart can come back. And one is dreaming big. Where some see a Rust Belt town in decline, he sees the perfect spot for a balmy vacation getaway. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
I'm walking through the snow at the edge of a field here in Elkhart County. And right now there's just some corn stubble from last year's crop and a highway nearby, some woods over there. But the plan is to transform this area into a tropical paradise. They're talking about building some giant glass domes here that would cover indoor pools and rivers and some kind of tropical forest. There'd be water slides.
We envision this and dream that this will be a totally new type of family attraction that we've not seen in America.
That's Leroy Troyer, a local developer and architect.
We plan to have about 100 amenities of activities, all the way from bowling to indoor basketball, tennis, soccer, miniature golf.
There would also be 600 villas for tourists to stay in. This, it wouldn't be a regular hotel with a swimming pool. Troyer pictures lush green areas with the villas nestled in the trees and those giant glass domes rising, he says, like huge mushrooms.
With the domes, can you just imagine the toadstool type of mushrooms only be gigantic, big, like a full acre.
Okay, this might sound kind of crazy, and Troyer realizes that, but here's why it's actually not so crazy. Troyer is a successful local developer. Back in his office, he explains that for years, he's been trying to come up with ways to bring more tourists to Elkhart. And one day, a friend of his from Holland told him about these glass-domed resorts that they already have all over Europe.
And he was real excited about it, how families come to this place. They stay for 3-4 days or a week. They have water, they have plants, they have villas. And the families come, unload their car, and the rest is a walking community.
And they've become very popular in areas with cold winters.
And that was a real wow to me.
There are about 40 in Holland, there are about 8 in the UK, there are about 10 in Germany, and about 15 in France.
Robert Vejenka has been in charge of operations for many of these resorts in Europe. He was with a company called Center Parks. And Leroy Troyer from here in Elkhart tracked him down, flew to the Netherlands, and met with Vejenka.
We were very excited. We always have thought that America is a very good destination.
And it turns out that Elkhart, Indiana could be an especially good place. Vejenka says that these resorts work as inexpensive family vacations that you can drive to.
If you want to just relax for a couple of days, you just get into your car. You don't have to hassle to go to the airports with all the security.
And Elkhart is between Chicago, Indianapolis, and Cincinnati, and it's got 35 million people within a 3 or 4 hour drive. That's more than twice the population of the Netherlands, and there are 40 of these resorts there.
Yeah, and they have an average occupancy between 85 and 90% all year round.
Vejenka has been working with Troyer on drawing up plans for the resort, which would be called Family Holiday Village Elkhart. They say it would create 500 jobs on site and more jobs in the surrounding community. Workers are building modular homes inside a big warehouse run by Commodore Corporation. It's a local home builder that's been talking to the resort developers. Rod Davis, one of the managers, has overseen some heavy layoffs in recent years.
There was a guy, Jack, that worked up in Final Finish that it was really hard to let him go because he had been here for a long time.
Getting the contract to help build the resort would mean the company could hire back a lot of those workers.
It would be great to get this and have those people come back to work.
Whether any of this is actually going to happen depends on coming up with $200 million that it'll take to build this resort. And right now, banks and investors are not exactly throwing money at big construction projects. Still, the head finance officer says that he's in discussions with investors, and he hopes to see a groundbreaking sometime this year. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The Secretary of Education this week declared a new commitment to enforcing civil rights laws. Arnie Duncan said the prior administration did not adequately examine civil rights issues in schools, and the Education Department is already looking at one place, the school system in Wayne County, North Carolina, where a controversy over redistricting is raging. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio reports.
It's the end of a long day at Goldsboro High School, and students fill the narrow hallways, on the way to buses, practices, or home. Goldsboro is a classic American high school. White columns, two-story brick facade, transoms over the classroom doors. 60 years ago, and just up the stairs at the end of the hallway, a teenage Carl Castle took drama from an energetic teacher named Andy Griffith. Now, students like Michael King roam these hallways.
All the students here at Goldsboro High School have had a good opportunity to do anything they wanted to. Some just choose not to take the opportunity.
Michael is a success story, to be sure. He lives with his mother and brother. Their only family income is her disability check. He hopes to go to college. But most of his peers won't escape the cycle of poverty here. Patricia Burden is the principal at Goldsboro High School.
I think you have students who truly believe that this is the way that I live and this is the way that I will continue to live. And so therefore, they do not have the broad perspective on the fact that it does not have to be this way.
About 80% of the students at Goldsboro High are poor. 99% are African American. Other high schools in America have similar student bodies. But what makes Goldsboro High different is that the town and the school district are roughly 50-50 black-white. The other five high schools in Wayne County are majority white or close to it and don't have nearly the same levels of poverty. Reverend William Barber is a pastor at the Greenleaf Christian Church in town, and he's also the president of the North Carolina NAACP.
We have apartheid education in Wayne County.
Barber and the NAACP filed a complaint against the Wayne County schools in December. They say the school board violated the 1964 Civil Rights Act when it created attendance areas that put the majority of the poor black students in one school zone and failed to provide students in that zone with equal educational opportunities.
This is a ugly case, a wrong case. We believe in a legal case. And the NAACP and our friends, we had to challenge it because it is so endemic of what can happen when you leave local school boards alone in the South to do their business.
Barber calls the school board's actions discrimination, and he also uses another word, resegregation.
And I don't even know if that's a word in the dictionary, to be honest with you, resegregation. It may be.
Rick Pridgen is the chair of the school board in Wayne County.
The schools have nothing to do with and can't change the demographics of the city. You know, the schools has absolutely nothing to do with where people choose to live.
The civil rights divisions at the Departments of Education and Justice are coordinating a federal investigation. Civil rights advocates see Wayne County as a test case for the Obama administration's stated rededication to civil rights. Mark Dorison is a senior attorney with the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina.
The Wayne County case is particularly egregious, but it is also symbolic or emblematic of the trends we're seeing not only across North Carolina, but across the country.
Neither the Department of Justice nor the Department of Education would comment on the ongoing investigation in Wayne County. The local school board says it will cooperate fully with the investigation. For NPR News, I'm Dave DeWitt in Durham, North Carolina.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. The Earth has been moving a lot lately. In the space of just a few months, we've experienced deadly earthquakes in Haiti, Chile, and Turkey. Yet another quake caused damage in Taiwan. Earthquake scientists don't see a direct link between these quakes, but earthquake activity has increased since the huge Indian Ocean earthquake in 2004 and its resulting tsunami. That has led some scientists to wonder whether big quakes can, in fact, increase seismic activity around the world. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
After a big quake, there are always local aftershocks. But Earth scientists used to poo-poo the idea that a big quake in one part of the world could trigger another quake thousands of miles away. Emily Brodsky at the University of California, Santa Cruz, says that belief started to give way in 1992.
There was a real change in understanding about distant connections between earthquake at the time of an earthquake in Southern California called the Landers earthquake.
That 7.3 magnitude quake hit a remote part of the California desert. It didn't cause widespread damage, but like other big quakes, its seismic waves bounced around the world, and in fact,
it triggered very small earthquakes as far away as Yellowstone National Park.
Brodsky says those quakes occurred just as the seismic waves got to Yellowstone, so there's no question that the big quake triggered the little ones. And seismologists have since found other examples.
There's a beautiful one from Sumatra that shows up in Alaska, that as the individual pulses of the waves come through, there are individual earthquakes popping off.
The Chilean quake last month triggered tiny quakes in Nebraska, Brodsky says.
The key question at this point is whether or not those distant interactions are just triggering little earthquakes or can actually trigger something significant.
There's no reason to think that the magnitude 7 quake in Haiti triggered the other damaging quakes this year. After all, earthquakes are actually pretty common, so coincidences should be as well. There are, on average, 17 magnitude 7 quakes a year globally, and 130 quakes each year in the magnitude 6 range. We just notice the ones that do damage, and we've had a very unlucky streak. That said, Brodsky notes that there have been more big quakes than average since the devastating 9.1 quake hit Sumatra back in 2004.
In some sense, there is a possibility that this is an aftershock sequence of Sumatra, but I want to say that very cautiously. It's a possibility. It is not something we know.
Huge earthquakes do sometimes come in clusters. Notably, the three truly enormous quakes of the 20th century all occurred within a span of 12 years. Russia in 1952, Chile in 1960, and Alaska in 1964. So you've got to wonder whether big quakes cluster together.
Yeah, I can see why people think that, which is why we actually did the calculations.
Andrew Michael at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California, looked into the recent uptick of quake activity to see if there's an unusual pattern. He started off assuming what most scientists do, that earthquakes occur randomly.
It doesn't mean that they're evenly spaced out in time, but randomly means that actually there will be sort of what seem like clusters that are really just coincidence.
Imagine tossing a handful of rice on the floor at random. You'll inevitably find some grains clumped together. And in fact, Michael finds that the clumping of earthquakes can be explained simply as randomness.
I think when people think there's an interconnectedness, then they think, well, there's been a lot of big earthquakes. They should be really worried right now that there's going to be more. I don't think that's the case.
It is still possible that a large quake might very occasionally trigger other large quakes, he says, but it doesn't happen often enough to be obvious in his data. Even so, the globally reverberating seismic waves do provide a possible mechanism. So he says it's a question well worth exploring. As Emily Brodsky puts it,
at risk of sounding like a scientist, more research is necessary.
They also agree that more big quakes are inevitable in the long run, so the world needs to be prepared for them, regardless of what sets them off. Richard Harris, NPR News.